Right now, we're going to hear some music by Cuban singer-songwriter Frank Delgado, followed by my commentary on what Cuban socialism has to tell us. Last month on The Old Mole, I discussed my impression, following a trip to Cuba at the end of April, that while Cuba can be described as poor by North American standards, their poverty is not demoralizing, unlike poverty elsewhere. Theirs is a poverty without squalor. I said that this was because their condition is widely shared and because their world is comparatively free of the obscene consumerism that constantly presents itself to us in the media and all around us. Now, Cuba is a very small country, but it's important because it is the one nation among those that abolished capitalism in the 20th century that has most successfully resisted the resurgence of capitalism over the past 30 years. Indeed, it is the one nation still standing where the resources and labor of the nation are organized not to maximize the return on investment for corporations and their wealthy owners and executives, but are managed by the state to benefit the nation as a whole. This fundamental distinction between the aims of a capitalist economy and those of a socialist economy remains, regardless of further questions we may ask about how well the Cuban state has done at benefiting the population. I think this will become clear if we look at the history of the evolving Cuban Revolution. Today, when more people in the U.S. are sympathetic to the idea of socialism, it's a good time to see what we can learn about socialism from its most able practitioners. For many years after the revolution of 1959, the Cuban economy was able to function in spite of the U.S. trade embargo, thanks to generous help from the Soviet Union. But with the collapse of the Eastern Bloc, Cuba fell on very hard times. But to quote from Professor Emily Morris, rather than embark on a process of liberalization and privatization like others in the Soviet bloc, the Cuban approach preserved and built on its existing institutional assets. These included not only the welfare state, price controls, and national ownership of the means of production, but also a capacity for a state-led collective response that benefited from a long-standing tradition of galvanizing voluntary support through mass mobilizations and a policy process that could draw on mechanisms for public participation and debate. End of quote. Then conditions improved towards the end of the 1990s as the U.S. permitted more Cubans living in the U.S. to send money to relatives on the island, and as Venezuela under Hugo Chavez traded oil for the services of Cuban doctors. In addition, the Cuban government began to relax its prohibitions against private businesses, and more tourists arrived from Europe and Canada, whose governments, unlike the U.S., did not prevent their citizens from traveling to Cuba. It was, though, only a minority of Cubans who worked in the tourist industry or had affluent relatives abroad, and who were thus able to rise above their neighbors. To meet the desires of its people for a better and less difficult way of life, Cuba needs to both attract foreign investment and to improve the productivity of its economy, while at the same time keeping the promise of the revolution to ensure that everyone has enough to eat, a place to live, as much education as they can use, and good medical care. Few Cubans want to rescind the revolution. According to journalist Mark Frank, who has lived in Cuba for many years, discontent runs deep in Cuba, where no one has made a really living wage for two decades, But most Cubans are seeking change through reform and evolution of the system, not in open alliance with Washington and Miami's political establishment, which seeks regime change. Most Cubans are dissidents, just not dissidents as they are known abroad. Under Raul Castro, measures have been taken to modify the system by adding to the private sector and decentralizing the decision-making involved in the economy. There are now many private restaurants, quite good ones, I can testify, and other small businesses, and some food is being sold by private markets rather than in state stores, though at much higher prices. Large state companies like those in the sugar industry, nickel mining, and tobacco have been cut loose from government ministries and left on their own to buy supplies and sell their goods. Associated with these changes have been large layoffs of government workers who must then find other employment in the new private sector. Now, these changes have not just been laid down from on high. Although it is not a political democracy in our sense, quoting again from Emily Morris, Cuba has a vast array of mass organizations that constitute its effort to create a participatory system. National debates have been launched at critical moments, involving assemblies throughout the island, open to everyone. As the economic problems deepened, thousands of meetings were held, not only in Communist Party branches, but also in workplace assemblies and mass organizations, unquote. Tying income to productivity in order to increase efficiency may lead to somewhat wider income gaps and social divisions. Yet several features of Cuba's historical experience and policies suggest that socialist principles will largely prevail. First, throughout all its crises, Cuba has never turned to policies of austerity, but has maintained its universal welfare provision in spite of a uniquely hostile external environment, and therefore it has prevented extreme and debilitating poverty and social hardship. It has also consulted extensively with the people about the crisis and how the system is adjusting. By maintaining state control over prices and wages, Cuba has been able to keep the cost of living manageable for people. The most fundamental difference between Cuba and most of the countries in the rest of the world is that the government of Cuba is fundamentally responsible and responsive to the people of Cuba. Now, of course, every government claims to represent its people and to govern on their behalf, but people everywhere have been waking up to something socialists have always known. A society that is dominated economically by capital is also dominated politically by capital. It's not just that the very rich can buy their way into political power. It's that a capitalist society is structured so that the welfare of capital is what everyone's welfare depends upon. Not so in Cuba. The survival of Cuba's socialist system, and therefore the interests of its officials from the Castros on down, is not dependent on a wealthy class of investors, but on the willingness of the Cuban people to cooperate. So while the Cuban Communist Party cannot be voted out of office, it can exist and succeed only so long as the system it runs works for the people. Raul Castro reportedly said to some members of the younger generation of party leaders who will be succeeding him, "Fidel had the authority, that is, the trust of the people, to keep the system together even when it wasn't working very well. I, as his brother, have a little of that authority, but you have no such authority, so you will have to make the system really work." And that means work in the real lives of the Cuban people, not for the bottom line of the balance sheet of corporate assets. This is the lesson Cuba can teach us, the deeper meaning of socialism, now that we're more ready to hear that word. I'm Clayton Margaridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Allí amé a una mujer terrible, llorando por el humo siempre eterno de aquella ciudad acorralada por símbolos de invierno. Allí aprendí a quitar con piel el frío y a echar luego mi cuerpo a la llovizna en manos de la niebla dura y blanca en calles del enigma.